From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. A year and a half of Donald Trump's presidency is more than most Americans have been able to tolerate. The levels of corruption and overt flouting of the U.S. Constitution, the race baiting, the demagoguery, the misogyny, and more are unprecedented. The U.S. has perhaps never before had such an impeachable president as Trump. Now a new book written by three veteran constitutional lawyers makes the case that Trump's impeachment is imperative and that in fact the U.S. Constitution itself demands it. Ron Fine is legal director of the group Free Speech for People. He's a constitutional lawyer who previously served as assistant regional counsel in the U.S. EPA, and he's the co-author with John Bonifaz and Ben Clements of the new book, The Constitution Demands It, The Case for the Impeachment of Donald Trump. Welcome to the program, Ron.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
So we had interviewed Alan Lichtman very early in Trump's presidency, who wrote the book predicting that Trump would be impeached and laid out this detailed set of cases around, any one of which could make a good case for impeachment. Your book comes out a year and a half into the presidency, and it seems as though every other day there's a new reason that Congress could use to impeach Trump. How would it work? Let's remind our audience what the mechanics of impeachment are so that we can discuss whether it's actually a feasible thing.
Sure. So the Constitution provides that the president can be impeached and removed from office for high crimes and misdemeanors, which is a phrase we can talk about later. And the basic process is that it starts in the House of Representatives, which usually begins by investigating the charges through a committee, such as the Judiciary Committee. And then if the Judiciary Committee recommends articles of impeachment, then the full House would have to approve articles of impeachment by a majority vote. And if the House does that, then it goes to the Senate for a trial. And the trial is held, and then if two-thirds of the senators vote to convict the president, then he is removed from office.
So the House is where it starts. And of course, all eyes are on the midterm elections, where there are predictions that Democrats could flip the House. So we can talk a little bit more later about the feasibility of it. What are the, I'm sure any person who's been following the Trump administration would be able to list several things on one hand about issues that are impeachable or violations that are impeachable. But what are the cases that you lay out in your book, the most egregious violations of the U.S. Constitution that the House could use to start impeachment proceedings?
So in the book, we lay out eight grounds for impeachment hearings. And of these eight, it's important to know that two of them overlap with Special Counsel Mueller's investigation, and six of them don't. And that's important to know because a lot of people are under the impression that impeachment has to wait until the special counsel completes his investigation. But of our eight grounds, six of them have nothing to do with the Mueller investigation. And these are broad-ranging because they include all of the corruption and abuse of power that we've seen. They started with a violation that the president was committing from the moment he took the oath of office, which is violating the Foreign and Domestic Emoluments Clauses of the Constitution, which are provisions that prevent the president from taking money from foreign government or domestic governments. And they include obstruction of justice, soliciting foreign help from the Russian government in the election campaign, abuse of the pardon power, directing law enforcement to persecute political adversaries, and several other grounds. And a key point of this is that any one of these is sufficient to start impeachment hearings. When you put them all together, the case is overwhelming.
So the constitutional, the constitution, the parts of the Constitution that are violated in this is, you would imagine that this would be a huge issue with Republicans who claim that the U.S. Constitution is the basis for their actions, that it's a sacred document. These are, you know, they claim the mantle of patriotism. You know, Trump has made so much about saluting the flag during the and the national anthem, but when it actually comes to respect respecting the document that lays out the framework for our democracy, he has shown how little respect he has for it. I want to just stay on the emoluments clause for a minute because that's such a critical one. Trump came into this presidency as a businessman. We have not really, as far as I can remember or as far as my history knowledge goes, had a president that has had this many businesses under his control as Trump when taking the office of the presidency. What could he have done to not violate the emoluments clause? Would it have meant walking away from his entire business and all his corporations?
So there were a number of options that were available to Trump. And during the transition period between the election and the inauguration, a lot of people, including some former chief ethics counsels for previous presidents, Democrat and Republican, offered to advise Trump on how he might be able to do this. The answer is ultimately that it's the president's responsibility to figure out how to make his personal assets fit with the requirements of the job rather than to try and bend the Constitution to be able to hold on to his businesses however he wants. But the gold standard in a case like this is what's called a blind trust, in which he would have had his businesses need to be, in his case, because they're so personally associated with him, they would have needed to be sold off. And then his assets could be invested by a trustee who would not tell Trump what it was that he owned. And many previous presidents have been wealthy. Some have owned businesses, and they've all used different mechanisms to fit into these constitutional requirements. Most famously, Jimmy Carter sold a peanut farm in Georgia in order to make sure that he wasn't violating any of these provisions.
Right, because if there was even a whiff of impropriety that somebody wanting to curry favor with Carter might have gone and wanted to, you know, buy up a bunch of peanuts from his peanut farm and then ask for something in return, that would have essentially been an abuse of power, conflict of interest. But with Trump, you have foreign diplomats and anybody, you know, who's looking to have a word with the president or show how much they support the president, they can go and stay at the Trump International Hotel in Washington, D.C. when they go for visits to the nation's capital. And when it comes to choosing which hotel to stay at, why would they not choose Trump's own hotel that personally benefits him? This should have been, you know, the main impeachable offense, but it seems to have gotten lost in all of the other issues that keep getting raised around Trump.
Well, I think it set a bad tone because the fact is that the president was violating this from the moment he took the oath of office, and Congress basically did nothing about it. Now, if Congress had said, you need to, you know, solve this problem immediately or else we're going to start impeachment proceedings, if Congress had done that early on, then that would have given Trump a sense that he was restrained, that he couldn't do whatever he wanted with impunity. But instead, because of Congress's inaction, Trump early on learned the lesson that he could get away with a lot.
I'm glad you put it at the feet of Congress, because the Republican Party seems to have sacrificed the Constitution in order to further their political agenda. And Trump knows that, and they know that. The Republican Party controls, until, you know, at least for the next few months, Congress. Is it essentially this party's responsibility for allowing all of these things to take place? Or have the Democrats also failed? Some have spoken about impeachment, but it seems as though even the Democrats haven't strongly raised it.
Yeah, I think both parties are to blame here. And the Democratic Party leadership has consistently shut down efforts to even raise the question of impeachment. There have been some members of the House, such as Al Green and Steve Cohen and Brad Sherman and Maxine Waters, who have taken a role in speaking about impeachment or even bringing things to the House. But the leadership of the Democratic Party, as well as the Republican Party, has consistently tried to stifle that. And I think both parties are making a short-term political calculation that is really putting the long-term interests of the nation in second place to their own party interests.
Let's talk about the issue of definitions and vagueness. The issue of the term high crimes and misdemeanors is a very vague term. Can the Republicans make a case that nothing that Trump has done actually fits that bill, and that people are who want to impeach him are just against him because he's a bold president and they don't like the fact that he's a businessman? What do high crimes and misdemeanors mean?
Yeah, in the book, we lay out the case for why each of these eight grounds meet that standard. High crimes and misdemeanors is a term that the framers of the Constitution inherited from the legal practice in England, where Parliament would impeach officials for high crimes and misdemeanors. And it meant, at the time, serious offenses, which may or may not be crimes, and they could include abuses of power, abuses of the public trust. But the key point is that they're offenses committed by politicians against the country itself. They're not minor crimes. They're not sort of purely personal offenses. These are offenses that threaten the very foundations of the rule of law and constitutional democracy.
Now, the book that you've written also lays out several other bases for impeachment that are about how Trump has fomented violence, encouraged violence, and all levels of violence, whether against individuals, aimed at countries, or even against the entire press industry, entire vocation of journalism. Can you lay those out for us? He has been quite specific, and his Twitter feed would essentially offer plenty of documentation for what he is, for the kind of violence he's called for, right?
Yeah, and this is all out in the open. So this is a good example of something that's not dependent on the Mueller investigation. It's not about finding a secret tape. This is all public information. But since the election campaign itself, when Trump was often exhorting people who were at his rallies to beat up protesters, to knock the crap out of them and so forth, he's been continuously advocating for illegal violence. In one case, he told an audience of police officers they should be rough with suspects and manhandle them and bang them on the head as they got into a squad car. In another case, he basically advocated committing war crimes against Muslims, and he's often retweeted inflammatory videos. And when you put this all together, maybe you would say any one incident by itself wouldn't rise to the level of an impeachable offense. But the president has the obligation to take care that the laws be faithfully executed, to protect the country against domestic insurrections, like the type of neo-Nazi marches that we saw in Charlottesville last year, in which he praised both sides, or he said there were problems on both sides, and he praised very fine people among the white supremacist marchers. And he also has an obligation to ensure the equal protection of the laws. And this is an area where the president has not just failed, but has actively trampled on these obligations.
So the constitutional responsibility to protect the nation from violence is what he is violating by being the source of the inspiration for violence, right? I mean, we are seeing people who commit violent acts literally citing Trump personally when engaged in hate crimes, verbal or physical abuse. That is pretty damning.
And they call it the Trump effect. And there have been studies that have shown that starting with the election campaign in 2016, but continuing, that when Trump is giving a rally in a city, violence increases, and often racial incidents increase. The name Trump has turned into a race-baiting cry. So if there's someone chanting Trump, Trump, Trump at, let's say, a high school basketball game, everybody understands what that means, particularly if one of the teams is from a a community that's predominantly of color. So he's actively fomenting this type of violence. He may not explicitly call for it on one particular occasion, as he did during the campaign, but his rhetoric and his actions promote it.
And then on the violence that he has called against the media, that I'm assuming is a violation of the First Amendment, when the president labels the media the enemy of the people, when he posts on his Twitter feed a doctored video of him punching out person embodying an entire media network, in that case CNN, he's essentially violating or being considered to be violating the First Amendment of the Constitution?
Yeah, and there have been court cases where freedom of the press or freedom of the speech was found to be violated by a government official giving this type of pressure. But what's really important to note is that this is not just one incident. And we waited a while before we were ready to say that there was enough to call this a ground for impeachment hearings on its own, because one tweet wouldn't necessarily rise to that level. But when you put it together with all of his rhetoric about the press being the enemy of the American people, when he's threatened to use law enforcement to punish the independent press, when he's pressured news companies to fire particular reporters based on stories he doesn't like, when he's threatened to use the Postal Service to raise shipping rates on Amazon as an indirect way of punishing the Washington Post because they share an executive, this all together is a way that undermines the freedom of the press. And one thing that we've seen in other democracies that have slipped out of constitutional democracy like Turkey or Venezuela is that strongman leaders have found that you can undermine the press even without direct censorship.
And there is news now that Trump is essentially going to be launching Trump TV, which is, somewhat strange that you would end up, you would have this president who's creating his own media empire. And often that's seen as another hallmark of authoritarian governments, right? Government control of media. Not just attacks on independent media, but then control of their own media network. What about the family separation issue in the immigration debate with the violence that Trump's very direct decision of so-called zero tolerance for immigrants coming into the U.S. across the border, the cruelty of family separation has done very serious harm to children? Does that rise to the level of violating the U.S. Constitution? One would hope it would.
Yeah, this is an issue that was coming to public light just as we were finishing the book. So we mentioned it briefly, not in as much detail as the other issues.
So the next edition, which hopefully there won't be a next edition because hopefully he'll be impeached, but if there is a next edition, you could have a chapter on that?
Yeah, I think we would need to. We're now calling that a ninth ground for impeachment hearings, and it is based on cruel and unusual punishment of children and their families by using this detention policy as a means of basically punishing the parents for something that's actually, in most cases, immigration violations are actually just a misdemeanor offense, and to basically, to warehouse children in internment camps is a cruel and unusual punishment of the children who have done, in many cases, nothing wrong, and of the parents who, in many cases, have done nothing wrong, or at most, a misdemeanor violation.
Ron, let's talk about those impeachable offenses that are being investigated by the special counsel, Robert Mueller, and his team. The first trial was aimed at, had in its center, Paul Manafort, for issues that weren't related to collusion, but of course, it's fair game that Mueller prosecutes any crimes that arise from his investigation. But specific to Donald Trump, what are the cases that are impeachable? And can Mueller's investigation directly lead to impeachment if Trump isn't impeached before the investigation wraps up?
So what's important to understand is that even for these two cases which overlap with the Mueller investigation, Congress's authority is independent of the special counsel's. Congress doesn't need to wait for special counsel to conclude his criminal probe. And the reason that's important is that there are limits on what the special counsel can do that really have nothing to do with Congress and the impeachment power. And just to give two examples, when the special counsel is looking at whether he can charge a particular criminal offense, he's got to focus on the technical statutory definitions of the crimes. And in obstruction of justice, for example, most of the federal statutes turn on whether the defendant interfered with what's called a proceeding. And the definition of a proceeding is something that different federal appeals courts have defined differently, and whether an FBI investigation at a certain stage could be considered a proceeding is the type of issue that would need to be considered carefully in a prosecution decision. It really has nothing to do with impeachment. I mean, what we've seen with obstruction of justice is that Trump has quite clearly in the open used almost every authority he can find, as well as some that he doesn't even have, to try to shut down Department of Justice and FBI investigations into his own conduct and that of his subordinates. And the second issue is that the prosecutors will have to consider what type of evidence can be put before a jury in a federal court. And there are limits on rules of evidence about things like hearsay and so forth that, again, Congress does not have to abide by the same rules that would apply in a federal criminal trial.
So if Mueller's investigation does result in certain recommendations, that target Trump, can that be the basis, even if Congress doesn't need Mueller's investigation, but feel that it might give them greater impetus or greater legitimacy? Can they use it, the results of his investigation, to effectively as a basis for impeachment?
They sure can, and the key point that we're trying to make is they don't need to, right. And The special counsel seems to be moving quickly, and he has done what seems to be a good job at bringing additional facts to light through the indictments and the plea agreements that we've seen so far. Congress also has investigative authorities, and it could be using its hearings to bring out some of the same information. So it doesn't need to wait for the special counsel, but it's certainly free to use and encouraged to use anything that does come out of his process.
Now, you have your book has been praised by billionaire hedge fund manager Tom Steyer, who is an individual who has poured in millions of dollars into pushing an impeachment effort. It's kind of sad that this is happening because, of course, Congress is not acting. Does his effort show any promise? Could it lead anywhere?
Well, we think it's great that Tom Steyer has been able to help lift the question of impeachment into the public conversation in a way that it wouldn't if not for those efforts. What we are hoping to do with this book is to provide the substance, because a lot of people either they feel intuitively that Trump has done something wrong, but they don't understand the full range of the facts or why it's an impeachable offense. And then there are some people who just haven't been following the news closely enough to know exactly what it is that he's done and why it's grounds for impeachment. So we're hoping that our book and all the other efforts, including from Tom Steyer and the Need to Impeach campaign, will help bring this into the live national conversation.
So tell us about about where people can find out more. In addition, of course, getting a copy of your book, is there a website that offers people resources? Because Congress won't act unless they're pushed into acting. And it is already a long, drawn-out process, as you described, with the House having to first do the investigation and then the Senate having to conduct a trial if the House pushes for it. So Congress needs to feel the heat from the grassroots. So what can ordinary people do?
That's a great question. So first of all, I should say at the end of the book, we have a list of steps that individuals can do, including scripts for talking to their member of Congress or for sample letters to the editor. And we have a website at impeachmentproject.org, which people can visit, and it has information about the book and information about the impeachment campaign, as well as other efforts to hold the president accountable for his violations of the rule of law.
That's impeachmentproject.org. We'll link to that from our website. Thank you so much, Ron.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Ron Fine is legal director of the group Free Speech for People and a constitutional lawyer who previously served as assistant regional counsel in the U.S. EPA. And we've been discussing the new book he just co-authored with John Bonifaz and Ben Clements called The Constitution Demands It, The Case for the Impeachment of Donald Trump. It has a foreword by John Nichols. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter, subscribe to our audio podcast on iTunes, and our video channel on Vimeo.